Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. And here is Bookworm. Welcome. I'm very happy today because one of my favorite Los Angeles-based writers, Sarah Shunlin Bynum, has a new book of stories. Up until this point, she's written two novels. I am really stunned by the first, Madeline is Sleeping, and the second, Mrs. Hempel Chronicles. And now we've got a book of short stories called Likes, L-I-K-E-S. And for all of you who are going to want to get this book right away, let me spell Sarah's name. It's Sarah, S-A-R-A-H, Shunlin, that's S-H-U-N hyphen L-I-E-N, Bynum, B-Y-N-U-M. Tell me what your ethnic background is, Sarah.
Michael, it's so wonderful being back on the show. Thank you for having me. And my background is my mother is Chinese, which is where my middle name comes from her side of the family. And then my father is that sort of mishmash of Western European, Welsh, English, a little bit of German. So that is what comprises me, as far as I know.
One of the things I noticed is that for the first time in this book, Likes, the characters reveal themselves mid-story to be black or brown. Their nature is a revelation. And one of the things about the stories and the people in the stories is that they often find themselves in worlds where they feel they are out of place. And so in the very first story, which is one of my favorites, The Earl King, a mother is taking her child to a school party. The school party has elves and fairies, but best of all, it has a mysterious tall person in a cloak who is perhaps the Earl King, the Elf King. And the Elf King is famous in a poem for kidnapping a child, yes?
Yes, the Goethe poem, that was the basis for the story.
Wasn't it set to music by Schubert?
Exactly, exactly. There's the beautiful Lieder by Schubert.
I suspect that you've taken many of the things that you yourself like, Sarah, like this music, and set it in a world that is current, that is Los Angeles-based, and full of unexpected surprises, yeah?
Yes, it's very much a compilation of my own obsessions and favorites and trying to find a way to include them in stories, in, as you said, in ways that might not be expected.
This is a book that has 9 stories in it. All of them, I would say, are beautiful. One of them, a novella, appeared recently in The New Yorker called Many a Little Makes. And, you know, I think that Sarah and I have similar obsessions because when I was growing up, I was given to hear the expression, many a mickle, max a muckle. Many a small thing makes a big thing. And in this story, it's a story of three young people from second grade on who, over the years to adulthood, you've assembled the tiny details of life, the first sex, the danger that one of them has sex with another's brother, an incredible amount of detail making up, well, many a little makes a muckle, yeah?
Yeah. That was, I think, what makes me excited about the short story form as an unexpected way to contain a lot of life. We, you know, often the short story focuses in on a single moment in a life and expands that moment. And some of my favorite story writers, Joan Silber, Edward P. Jones, Alice Munro, they do this magic trick of somehow creating the feel of an entire lifetime, yet within the compressed frame of the short story. And so that was an effect that I was thinking about as I was writing all of the stories, but in particular, Many a Little Makes.
Now, many of these stories in this collection of stories, Likes, by my guest Sarah Shunlin Bynum, contain children. How many children do you have?
I have just one child, but childhood is, going back to obsession, certainly an obsession of mine, childhood and adolescence, and it's a subject that I have returned to in all of my books. And it's interesting because this is the first book that in its entirety has been, that I've written as a parent. And I think that, of course, being a parent both makes you nostalgic for your own childhood, but then also there's this sense of, for me, that my own experience, my own secret relationship with childhood is at risk of becoming eclipsed by what I'm experiencing now as a parent of my daughter's childhood. But I think some of the compulsion to write about it is both a compulsion to document what I'm witnessing as a parent and a compulsion to capture what I still remember of my own.
Well, in the first story, in the very last sentence of the story, the child disappears. It's a very interesting thing because this child has had many demands in the course of the story. She's a child who practically requires magical gifts, and she receives, in the story, a baby giraffe, and she is hoping for, like many children, you get one thing that you want and it leads you to the next. She would like a mommy giraffe to go with it. There's a room full of dolls. It's an extraordinary room because in this room, mother and daughter are looking for a brown doll, a doll that she can give to her daughter without demurral, without wishing that she could find a brown doll that's not wearing calico, that's wearing a beautiful dress like the other dolls. And there is this sense when the Earl King figure comes that this is a not so much a kidnapping as a magic trick, yes?
Yeah. Well, one of the sort of heartaches of being the parent of a African-American child is the dearth of images and stories and representations that are available to offer your child, that you so badly want your child to be able to see herself or himself reflected in the world around them, in the objects that they love, in the stories that they tell themselves. And as a parent, you are keenly aware of how difficult it is to populate their world with those images.
I had a friend who was once teaching cartooning to children at an art center here, and a good more than half of the children in the class were African American, and yet they did not want to draw African American cartoon characters. They had to be helped to see that it was okay. They'd been taught to see the cartoon world as a white world.
Yeah. And this is very much the world that the child in the story sees. Her favorite fantasy, her particular narrative obsession is Wizard of Oz. And a source of distress for her is that she doesn't look like Dorothy. And part of her fantasy with the Earl King is that among the magical gifts that he can provide is the gift of making her look like the Judy Garland version of Dorothy. That is her ultimate fantasy. And I think it is a kidnapping in a sense. It is at once, she is hoping for a magic trick, but in fact, it is a kidnapping because her own sense of fantasy, her own sense of herself has been absconded with by popular culture, by the narratives and the imagery that she has been surrounded by, and that even as her mother is gripping tightly onto her hand, her own interior life, her own imagination has been absconded with.
In these stories, in the book Likes, by my guest Sarah Shunlin Bynum, there is a fairy tale going on, and in the fairy tale, the possibility of multicultural friendships, magic. Who doesn't want to be Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz? There's a chapter called The Bears, in which a woman who's had a miscarriage has been invited to come and write about William James. And in particular, William James has an essay in which a bear appears. Fill me in.
So William James wrote an essay called What is an Emotion? And he theorized that our bodily response is actually what triggers our emotional response and not the other way around. And this was a rather radical way of conceiving of emotion at the time. So he argued that we cry, and the act of crying is what lets us know that we're sad, not that we feel sadness or loss and then begin to cry.
I found all of these stories, as usual with you, Sarah, you come at things from a set of very interesting obsessions. And here it's miscarriage and William James. It's a kind of astounding story. It's called The Bears. And I really had to read it two or three times, enjoying it and getting it more each time. How do you feel about the way a reader approaches your work?
Well, similar to James, I'm interested in knowledge that originates first in the body and that is then later recognized by the emotions or the intellect. So I think with all of my stories, I'm really hoping that a reader will have some kind of physical or visceral response before they might even know why they're having that response. So whether that's a tightening of the gut, or whether that's a flutter in the chest, or whether that's a sort of loosening of the limbs as you're reading, I'm always hoping that there might be this bodily experience that comes first.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to KCRW's Bookworm. I'm talking with Sarah Schoenlim Bynum about her new book, Likes. It's a book of short stories. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Sarah Schoenlim Bynum about her new book, Likes, 9 stories that represent a wide spectrum of literary possibilities. I just reread before we spoke a story called The Burglar, and in it, finally, a woman's husband has gotten a job he's been working toward with great diligence, writing for television. And he is a black man, and he has been given the responsibility to represent an innocent black man who's been jailed, falls through a time warp, and comes out of that time warp no longer innocent. He becomes a killer. The writer feels, I don't want this. I don't want to write a TV episode that I can't recommend that my parents watch. I don't want to misrepresent yet again a black person as innocent or guilty when they are neither. Now, tell me, as a short story writer, do you find yourself in that trap?
I think with every story, I'm trying to write out of that trap.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to use the story as a means of imagining lives of black and brown characters that don't conform to easy categorization, that don't conform to a simple understanding. I'm always trying to write out of that trap, and it comes very much back to the question that we were talking about earlier, just about the power of imagery and representation, how that power can be deadly, and really wanting that to imagine alternatives, like imagine interior lives and imagine families and imagine marriages and imagine friendships among characters coming from a wide range of ethnic backgrounds that where we sort of can't anticipate how those lives and those consciousnesses and those relationships are going to unfold. We can't sort of bring our preconceptions to these stories, because I just really want to capture the innate complexity and the mysteriousness of all of these lives.
Well, Sarah, I think that you succeed again and again in rescuing the unexpected from the grip of the expectable. In the final story, a black man, Ezra, is telling his son a bedtime story about the days when he used to go rollerblading in New York along the side of the Hudson. And one day, Julia Roberts crashes into him. He catches her, puts her on the ground, helps her to stand, and he has to explain that at one time, he's telling his son Ezra this, Julia Roberts was the most famous movie star in the world. But his wife is standing there too, and she doesn't remember this event and thinks perhaps he had told someone else about it in the past, someone he might have had a difficult relationship with. And the story keeps unfolding so that the bedtime story is the story about finding yourself in bed with the wrong person, with a movie star, or with a white woman, or with someone who goes to your gym. Anyone but your wife, who, in the course of this story, has to understand that forgiveness and forgiveness and forgive and forget, but forgive and forget is the motto of this story. And it seems to me that one of the beautiful things that you do is to provide contexts in which the characters are allowed to escape from their pasts.
I think the only amendment I might make is that the motto might be, rather than forgive and forget, it might be forgive and remember, or forgive and recreate. I think the story is her attempt to write herself out of the trap of a simplistic narrative. And in the simplistic version of the narrative, her fiancé betrays her with a white woman that he's met at the gym. That's the simplistic version of the narrative. And I think as she's standing there in the dark, listening to her husband tell the story to their child, I think she is trying to re-remember and rewrite that simplistic narrative. And by inhabiting her husband's point of view, by trying to relive those events through his perspective, she wants to understand that episode, that very painful episode. I think she wants to understand it in its layeredness and in its complexity and in its full context, and not simply let it become sort of fixed in her mind and in her heart in this very clear-cut black and white version. She wants to re-inhabit it through his eyes and through his body, so that she can understand it more completely and arrive at forgiveness that way.
Well, it's very interesting. My mother, who passed away in fairly recent years, I remember as a child, I would beg her for forgiveness, and she would say, I will forgive, but I won't forget. And I would practically on my knees say, please, please, please forget. One of the things I learned in this story, it's forgive and forget and forgive again and forget again and forgive again. And it fascinated me. I think you really have found a way of bringing a reader so close to your characters that we both forgive and forget. And it's amazing. I kept rereading these stories because I was ready to forgive, but I would immediately forget and I'd read all over again. Thank you, Sarah Schoenlem Bynum, for such a beautiful collection of stories.
Michael, thank you so much for reading it with so much heart and so much insight. It is big, big gift to me to be able to talk to you about them.
I've been talking with Sarah Schoenlem Bynum, author of Likes. It's a book of stories published by Farrah Straus and Giroux. I want to tell my listeners that we're each taping from our homes, so you may be hearing sounds that you wouldn't hear in a studio taping. And I'm sure that this conversation will interest you, unusual sounds or not. You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show, also available at Apple, Spotify, and all other podcast services. It can also be listened to on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. My special thanks to the Bookworm Show collaborators Alan Howard and Sean Sullivan, and technical director Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Henri Cole is our guest.